it's still like kind of not an easy ask to say, hey, we want to make a show about a 7-year-old woman. Like, that is not, right. You know, they don't, that's not what they lead with in screenwriting school when they teach you how to get the job.
Welcome to Trade Secrets, an HBO Max podcast where you get to listen in on an intimate and unexpected conversation between two great storytellers. Trade Secrets brings together actors, writers, directors, and other creative pros to discuss their work, process, and passions. And we make room for the surprises that come from chatting about everyday human experiences, too. We're talking quirky obsessions, the shows they watched growing up, and whatever it is that our guests want to explore. Today's conversation features two bosses behind the camera. In television, these are called showrunners. Brad Inglesby is the creator of HBO's limited series, Mayor of Easttown, and Jen Statsky is co-creator with Paul Downs and Lucia Aniello of the HBO Max comedy, Hacks. From the comfort of their homes in Southern California, they discuss the differences between writing alone and working in a writer's room, basketball, and what it's like to work in Hollywood when you come from a family who sees the film and TV world as totally foreign. And of course, they dish about the genius of the one actor they share in common on both their shows, the great Gene Smart. And as a heads up, please know there are hack spoilers in this conversation. Here are Brad Inglesby and Jen Statsky. Please enjoy.
Hey, Jen, how you doing?
Hi. I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing great. Where are you at right now?
I am in Los Angeles at my home. What about you?
I am here in Orange County, California. At my home.
Okay, cool. Your background looks pretty fun. I'm seeing a dartboard and a lava lamp, which is
really fun. This is my son's room. This is where I was told that the sound in the upstairs is best. I'm in my son's room.
It's like I thought you were just. I was like, Brad's a fun guy. I'm getting that right away from this.
Not even close. This is my life trying to pick a spot in the house where I could actually have some privacy, where the kids will be away for a little bit. And right now, the boys' room upstairs is the spot. So that's why the dartboard is here.
Got it. I wanted to ask you about kind of. Because what was so cool about Mare, by the way, I am a massive fan and thank you for creating it because it was such a joy. It became this cultural phenomenon. Like everyone was talking about it, everyone on Twitter, people were so into it. And it was so honestly like wonderful to have that experience again. I'm always curious how writers and creators and anyone receives like both criticism and just dialogue around the thing they've created, because for Hacks it was a challenge for me. I had written on shows, but I had never made my thing and then had the like response and criticism and reaction to it. And I really had to like struggle with, do I read it? Do I not? Do I engage? Like what's the, you know? And so I'm curious your experience with that, especially because you had it even crazier because it was like an instant hit and phenomenon, and far more people were, you know, talking about it.
Well, I don't know. Yours was huge too.
Thanks,
I mean,
thanks.
But yeah, I think, you know, I had the same experience because on movies, you know, I think what I genuinely like about movies is that I get to write a script, and in the best case scenario, you have a director that understands the vision and you get to kind of like just vanish in a way. Like I'm not really interested in being like a lot of writers that I talked to before Mayor were like, you got to get in TV because you get to be the boss. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't have any interest in being the boss. I'm totally okay.
Oh, that sounds terrible. I'll stay here.
Yeah, exactly. Like I don't have to do anything. I get to show up on set one, you know, a couple days and say hi to everybody and then leave. And so I think it was, you know, it was a bit overwhelming. It I have to be honest, because it was, as you said, it was the first time that it was something I created that was mine. I got to edit the show, got to be a part of every, you know, it was about my life. And not that I was a part of a murder investigation, but it was kind of about the people I grew up with. And so it was, you know, it was scary. I mean, it was super, super scary because we genuinely had no idea if the show was good. Now, you know, there are definitely, but like a movie, you test screen it a couple times. Yeah. You're in the theater with hundreds of people. They give you the test scores after. You kind of get a sense for, yeah, they're laughing when they're supposed to be laughing. They're crying when they're supposed to be crying. Like, you know, who knows if it'll break out, but we've seen it. Like with Mare, it was editing in the pandemic. I was editing at home on Evercast with our editors.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, I think it was maybe like episode 3 when Evan was at the bar drunk, Evan Peters.
Yeah.
When like someone wrote an article about it. And then it was like, oh, wow, this is like, I think they actually like the show.
Yeah.
It still kind of is. I mean, it's still kind of, you know, a strange sensation because I'm so used to being in the background, very happy being in the background, happy not being the face of a show or a movie. And to have to do that, you know, was tricky. But I think I'm just grateful I got to work with so many wonderful people who actually weathered a pandemic and went back to work in the midst of a pandemic and were able to keep each other safe. So, you know, it was, I think at the end of it, there was a lot of, I think just gratitude that I got to work with so many people who cared about the show and wanted to get it across the finish line. And so, yeah, but absolutely overwhelming. What was your experience? Like, how did you handle it?
Yeah, I mean, same. Like, it very much connects for me, your thing of like, we didn't know. We knew we liked the show. We knew that we were like, we would watch this. This is good to us. But like, I think we're just in this world when there's 20 million shows and everyone has limitless options for what they can watch. You just never know what's going to strike a chord with people. So it was that same thing of like not knowing how it would be received, but being proud of what we had done. And like you said, just proud of all the people we worked with who made it happen during a very difficult time to make television. But yeah, it's the same. And I also like tried to, like, I read things, but then I got scared. You know, I was like, I was constantly like putting Rotten Tomatoes on my block website list and then taking it off and then putting it back on. It was really bad.
Yep.
But yeah, that aspect of it was challenging for sure. And I hope maybe that the next thing, or like even just with another season, it will be less scary this time, just having been through it once, basically.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, because how do you, like, so you've had this, it's such a great show and the success has been huge and the response has been so overwhelming. So what do you... scared of with season 2, or how do you go into season 2 going, okay, I need to honor what people have responded to, but I don't know, do I want to give them the same thing? Or how are you, it's a tricky thing. How do you honor what you've done and keep the fan base you have that is still coming around because all the jokes are landing and the relationship is landing? And then how do you innovate in some way? And how do you do that? That has to be a tall task at this point.
The best I've figured out is don't think about it too much. don't think about the pressure of it. It's a little like, and I actually, wow, gorgeous segue, because I want to talk to you about growing up in basketball, because I am a massive basketball fan. I'm a huge NBA fan. So I think we have a lot to talk about. But like, it's a little bit, I'm looking at season 2, kind of like what an athlete needs to, how they think about a sport, is just like go into the game and trying desperately hard to not worry too much about, you know, like, we are so grateful for the fans and the people who love the show, and we want to honor them and give them something that will be satisfying for them. But I think if I can go really quickly down the road of focusing too much on what will the response be and not being like present in the moment with these characters and just thinking of it that. So I think that's to me the best way to do it.
I think that's really smart, because it's probably how you got, like, it's probably how you did season 1 anyway, right?
Exactly.
Like, I just love this story. If I'm in love with it, then I think my love will come through and people will respond to that, you know? But I understand, like, that is that you can get lost in what do people expect, and are they going to be mad if we give them the same thing? Or are they going to be mad if we don't give them what they came for? And I think I can very easily see myself getting wrapped up in expectations and trying to please people, whereas I never had those expectations in Mare, because I got to write it and no one was looking over my shoulder and no one knew what this thing was.
You're looking really smart with a limited series too, because then... don't have to worry about it.
Exactly right.
Yeah. You do such a wonderful job of like painting this picture of where you're from, and it feels so specific and lived in. And I think that's what people really responded to. Like, what I'm curious, like, what was your experience growing up there? And was it something that you were like, I've always wanted to write about it? Like, how kind of did that come about in this project?
I've always been a believer in, like, you know, in the specific is the universal. The more specific you can get, then, and the better it, I'd say the better chance it has of becoming universal to people. And with Mare, I felt like that was so important. As I said before, the story we've seen a million times. So, you know, we were never going to blow people away with this innovative plot. Mm-hmm. But what we could do is be so specific about the place and speak with a level of authority that you would drop them into a world and they would totally, like, and they would totally feel like they knew these people and that they had a connection with them, and that the honesty of the details and the living rooms and the pictures on the wall, it was like, if we can get all of these little things right, it's going to pay dividends at the end. Totally. because people will buy into the world. And so I think it is, yeah, like, you know, you get a couple nuggets, a couple pennies. As you said, you had this idea of hacks for years and years, but it always stayed with you. And that's what Mare was. It was like, I had a couple pieces that I, mm-hmm, always like, and they kept coming back to me. And then I get to a place where, like, a character is annoying me in my head so much, the only way to, I have to write them. And that, yeah, was Mare. And but I also just enjoyed writing about these people because it felt like I was revisiting my youth and getting to spend time with my aunts and my uncles and the people that were around the dinner table growing up. So it was a joy, you know, and all those conversations came easy to me.
Right. And I had read that you had moved back home, right? Like at some point in your writing career, like, can you tell, was that kind of, were you like, I'm over this, goodbye screenwriting? Or?
Yeah. Well, so I went to AFI for 2 years and then graduated and sort of like immediately moved home because I didn't really have an interest in mm-hmm, like just being on sets or being an assistant or a creative executive. I really was only interested in writing. Yeah. It's still kind of, and today, you know, really just, mm-hmm, I just love the writing, cracking the story, writing the characters. And so I felt like, hey, I need to go home and write. And so I went home. I spent about 2 years in insurance business, selling insurance. And then a script I wrote, it suddenly got in the hands of an agent. It sold. He's like, you got to move. Right. Like, you know, you got to move to California. And so, and then I've been here ever since. But that brings up a point. How did you get into the business? I had a champion who read my script. He sent it around. How did you get your big break?
So, you know, it was a couple of things. Like going to NYU obviously gives you access to these internships that were super, sure, important for me. I got to intern at SNL and I got to intern at Late Night with Conan O'Brien and also at The Onion, which was a, you know, satirical newspaper. Yeah. That was also doing web videos at the time. And so I got all these like wonderful like opportunities to interact with the business and see what it was like to be a working writer, director, producer, any of that. But, you know, internships don't always, like, I turned an internship into an assistant job. I was hired as an assistant. I was a writer's assistant. But that's such a tricky jump to make from assistant to actual paid hired writer. It's one of the most challenging things because there's not like one specific path. And so I was a little bit like adrift. I had been an assistant for like a year and a half. It was like a really challenging job. And then I said, okay, I'm going to like move to LA. This was back in New York. I'm going to move to LA because I think that's what TV writer, like that's what you need to do. And I did that, but I didn't really like have a plan for how I was going to, you know, get that first job. I was at the time applying to late night shows, doing like packets for that, not getting hired. And then, you know, this was 2011 and weirdly Twitter was like in a kind of having an important moment in comedy at that time, because there was this thing happening where people were just writing jokes on Twitter and they could be comedy writers or they, yep, could just be anyone from anywhere in the world. And if they were funny and their jokes were good, people were retweeting them and they were becoming kind of known that way. I think it was a cool moment. It was a meritocracy in a lot of ways, because it was like, you write a funny joke, doesn't matter, yep, who you are. Yeah. Funniest joke wins. And so,
right,
I was kind of just started writing jokes on Twitter and was enjoying that. And through that, the head writer at Late Night with Jimmy Fallon found me and messaged me on Twitter and was like, do you want to submit a packet? And I was like, yes. I could have said, oh, I've submitted so many, you haven't hired me off any. But, yeah, but I said, sure. And I did. And then I got the job that way. So that was my, like, how I broke into the first official paid writing job.
I see a lot of that on Hacks now. A lot of that experience comes through. I love that. So that a lot of the personal stories, writing jokes comes through on the show.
Brad, were there shows like growing up that made you want to be a writer that you loved? Shows or movies or books, anything?
Yeah, I think that, you know, growing up, the movies that probably, stood out to me the most. Breaking Away was the movie. It's a little like indie movie about a group of kids in Indiana. Oh, yeah. But yeah, it's kind of random. But it's
I've never seen that, but I've heard of it.
It's great. Yeah, it's really great. Boogie Nights was a movie that when it came out in theaters, I think I saw it maybe like, you know, 7 times in the movie theater because I was just could, you know, obviously see the talent there.
Right.
But just I thought what was so engaging about that movie was it was so human in a way. It was a world we hadn't seen before. It was an industry we hadn't really seen before. And the tone could go really sideways quickly. And it never did. And it held together, I think, by this, like, you know, just a sense of like a family story. And that to me was like, when I saw that movie and got to the end, when he's walking through the house, Burt Reynolds, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is a story about a family and just how you can find a family in the strangest of circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
And it moved me so much. And I think those were two examples when I was growing up that kind of, I always watched movies, but when I saw those and Breaking Away, I came to really late. I forget what year it was released, but I came to way later. Actually, it was in high school. My gym teacher showed it to us. And I was sort of like, oh gosh, here we go. And it just knocked me, you know, flat. And I revisited it a bunch. But what about you, Jay? I mean, what were the, you know, was it always shows or movies? What got you starting to think about actually, you know, making a career out of this?
TV was like so important to me growing up. I was an only child. And
you grew up where?
I grew up right outside Boston, Milton, Massachusetts. And so, yeah, I watched an incredible amount of TV growing up and not like kids shows. I watched like Nick at Night, like old sitcoms, like the Mary Tyler Moore Show is like so like I would say that is like the show that kind of really made me want to be a writer. And I didn't even know at the time when I was young and watching on Nick at Night and taking it in, like I didn't know exactly what a TV writer job looked like. I didn't know what the path was. I just knew that I was like so enamored with these characters and how it was funny but touching, and you love the characters and they, you know, you were rooting for them, like all the things that we love about TV and movies. And so that was you know, that, and then I kept, you know, Friends was and all those sitcoms, like they were just like so important to me. And as I got older, slowly started putting together like, okay, I think NYU is supposed to have like a good film and TV program. I'll see if I can get in there. And I did. And so that was kind of what the path was. But I'm curious because I think we're similar in this, like no one in my family has any connection to the business whatsoever. They don't get it at all. And so when my, you know, when I told my parents what I wanted to do, they were so baffled. They were just like, you know, it was like saying, I want to go to the moon. It's like, okay, I don't know how you're going to do that. Good luck. They really didn't get it. And I'm curious, you coming from this basketball family, you know, for anyone listening who doesn't know, your dad was an NBA player. Mm-hmm. Like what was the response? What was it like growing up, first of all, in like such a basketball forward house? And then what was the response when you said, oh, I actually want to be a writer?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, my parents are so like supportive. My dad is very practical. So his response, well, first of all, I didn't start writing until, so I went to Villanova, which is around where I grew up. It's a college around where I grew up. And I was in the business school mainly because I had no idea what I wanted to do. And my dad was like, it's fine and you don't have to know, but at least get a degree so that, you know, when you get out, if you wanted to get a job and, you know, get insurance and support a family, like have something, have a base so that you can be employable essentially.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't until I was a junior that I took a screenwriting class. And I had a teacher there who pulled me aside after class one day and was really lovely, sweet, sweet woman who kind of said, listen, are you interested in this? Because you're way more engaged, you know, than the other kids. Mm. And if you are, then like, I think you should try it. Cause I think, you know, you have a little bit of talent, like it's kind of raw, but like you can write dialogue. And truly, like, it was such a great little nudge that I needed. And I applied to a bunch of schools. Again, was lucky enough to get into AFI. But I think I will say this, Jen, my, a brother of mine, I had an older brother, Martin, was a really good basketball player, like really, really good. He went to Notre Dame. He played basketball at Notre Dame. He ended up coaching at Notre Dame for like 18 years. So he was really, really good. And I think, you know, because my dad was a player, you know, all the pressure was on my brother. I could sit in the basement and watch movies. I could be anything. It didn't really make a difference, right? I mean, all the pressure was on Mart, unfortunately. And he handled it well. He handled it in ways I just never could have. I just wasn't able to do it. But he was able to, he had a way about him where he was able to handle the pressure and deal with it. And so I think that helped because there wasn't any kind of expectation on me because Mart had been set up as the basketball player and he was able to carry the flag in a way that really I never could. And he was always incredibly gracious about it. He's such a lovely guy. So I think that I would say in a way it maybe it shielded me from having expectations in any way, right? It was like, well, you get to do whatever you want. Mart's the athlete and he's the, you know, if we're going to have an athlete in the family, it'll be Mart. And he's shown us he has the ability. And so I'm grateful that my parents were incredibly supportive. And even like you said, they had not a ton of interest in movies or stories. Yeah. I mean, they'll watch movies. I'm sure your parents will watch shows, but they're not in the business in any way and they don't have any connection.
Yeah, totally. And I was going to say too, when you were talking about your family and basketball like that, it also obviously, you know, Mare's connection to basketball, that's such a wonderful way you've woven that into the show. And it's also like, it's something that I don't think is like a story I've seen a ton of. Like, athletes are kind of, a lot of times athletes, people are like, oh, they're so lucky they get to play this game and they should just shut up and play. And I would love to get paid to play a game. But like, the thing that's really challenging, not that Mare was like a professional player, but athletes are, they have this limited window of their, when their success can happen and when they can work, and that it goes away fast. And Mare struggling with this kind of moment in her past that was like this glory moment that is what everyone still talks to her about, but it's not that for her. It's a burden in many ways, was so interesting to me because I think it's such a specific story about an athlete, though I haven't seen a ton. And I just really enjoyed that. And it's same thing. You wove your personal experience into that character.
Yeah. I think that's where you like, it was, you know, and I'm sure you've seen it, but I have so many of my buddies who are playing sports. They've committed themselves to a pursuit. And like you said, it really has an expiration date because unlike writing, you know, you can keep going as you get older, but in sports, the body starts to betray you in some way.
And, exactly.
And even the most passionate of the players isn't able to do it. Although I guess like a Brady is an example of a guy that continues to defy expectations, but you're right.
And I think he's like one out of a million. Yeah. Yeah.
He's one in a million. Yeah. He's one in a million. One of the things that I'm really curious about, I've never been in a writer's room.
Yes, I actually wanted to talk to you about this very thing.
I've never been in a writer's room. How do you keep up the setups and payoffs of the episodes when you have different writers coming in? Because, you know, everything tracks in every episode and the payoffs come in different, and a lot of them come in the same episode. But I'm actually really curious, are those things planned out in the writer's room, or does a writer, you know, write an episode and then say, you know what, I have a really good setup and payoff that may not track, but I think it's worth doing because everything tracks so wonderfully emotionally, but also just the jokes of an episode. But I'm really curious, like, how much of that is outlined in the room and how much of it is when you send the writers off to write
episodes and how much of it just comes up, you know, when you're staring at a blank page and you have an idea.
Yes, it is all planned out in the writer's room. So no matter how many writers you have, it is always Paul Downs, Lucia Agnello, and I.
Yep.
We are crafting the entire season and sort of are the guardians of like that entire arc for every character, every beat, every moment. So you sit in the room, like Paul, Lucia and I work a lot before the room starts, kind of laying out our vision for where the season begins and where it ends and some big moments in between, like tentpoles to hit.
Yep.
And then the room starts and we start filling in more specific details about the arcs or about the episodes we want to do, but it's all planned out in that way. And it's, we outline like really specifically, like we have pretty long outlines that have like dialogue and all that. And so that's not to say we have an incredible writer's room and they bring so much to both the room experience and their own individual scripts when they write. But in terms of like story turns and things that are, you know, like you're saying, are threaded through from the pilot to the last episode, that is all kind of figured out in the writer's room, whether it's from Paul, Lucia or I saying, pitching things or our writers pitching, oh, what if, you know, this could kind of be an interesting through line to follow. But yeah, it all happens in the room as part of a larger discussion and then gets like laid out in story docs and outlines before anyone goes off to write a script.
So let me ask you then, because this is my experience with writing, is that for as much outlining as, and I'm not really an outliner, that's just how I write. But
interesting.
It's because, you know, my experience with outlining is that I outline it, and then when I get to writing, the characters are telling me different things, and I have to go with that. Mm-hmm. I have to follow the voice. And so, like, are there moments where you go, it sounded really good in the room, but now I'm writing it, and guess what? Like, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's, like, impossible to avoid that in some way. Like, I will say that our outlines, like I said, they're pretty long, and they're pretty... like you're almost, there's dialogue written in every scene in the outline. So you're kind of, I think, making that discovery at the outline process. Like, sure, yes, there are times when you're writing that scene and you're like, this doesn't, you know, is this, no, stupid. Who wrote this outline? Me? I was an idiot. but like, for example, just like in episode 2, there's a moment where Ava is in this antique shop and she needs to get the pepper shaker for Deborah. And what she does is she grabs the vase and it like threatens to smash it on the ground.
What are you doing?
Sell it to me.
What, are you out of your mind? It's one of a kind.
Sell me it. I have nothing left to lose.
Stop.
I'll do it.
Put it down.
Sell me it.
You think you have nothing in common with Deborah Vance? I know you're the same. You're both psychotic bitches.
You have 3 seconds to take the money or I'm going to do it.
Please, think of the Obenshin McMillan
family.
What?
I don't give a fuck about the Obenshin McMillan. They probably overplayed.
That was not in the outline. The outline version, I think, was like, oh, she says something, some type of monologue that convinces him. She tells her story to him and that gets him. And then when Paul Downs, who wrote that episode, went off to write it, he was like, this, like, he brought it back to the room and he was like, you know, I did my best, but I just don't think this works. I don't think it's enough. She can't just do a monologue. Like, I don't buy that that's what's going to convince this guy to sell it to her, nor do I think it's as satisfying. And then at the room talked it through and someone had the pitch of doing the vase thing. And that was so great. And so it certainly happens for us that we get to script and we're like, oh no, what we thought worked in the outline doesn't. But, and then it's interesting, like you're, I think you're asking too, when you have a writer's room and like Paul, Lucia, or I, if we're doing that, we're the creator. So we can make that change. Writer's rooms are an interesting thing where like when you're just on staff, and I was for many years, like you kind of, if you encounter a hurdle like that, need to like go to the showrunner and pitch, either pitch them yourself. Hey, can I try this? Or what do you think about this bump? Because it's, you're not really, it's kind of like, you don't go off on a tangent and be like, well, I figured out a totally new story ending and your showrunner's like, oh, huh.
Yeah. Okay. I will say I love the vase moment at the antique store, and it's brilliantly acted in that moment.
Yeah, Hannah's so good. I'm curious for you, because for me, like, writing is so, I learned early on that like my worst nightmare is sitting down at a computer alone to write. Like, I really hate it. And I love being in writer's rooms. I love the like collaborative nature of beating out a story and talking about characters and all that. And especially in comedy, it's so like, sometimes I need to pitch the joke out loud and hear if people laugh at it to know if it's funny. And so I'm curious what your process is and how specifically writing Mare was like, are you able to just kind of like go into a hole and do it on your own? Or do you have like trusted creative people that you run stuff by, or what was the process like for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was always in movies. So my experience is like, you're writing a movie, and my experience was really writing spec movies. So I wasn't really actively involved. I did a couple, you know, rewrites, a studio job here and there, but for the most part, you know, my writing experience was specs. And so you write something and you hope it's good and you hope that you get an actor or director on. But if you don't, you spend 6 months, 8 months, a year of your life and you haven't gotten paid. And that's part of the bargain, or that's part of the deal when you start actually writing something on spec. But, you know, I it's funny. I'm not like totally introverted guy, but I don't like, I like getting out and socializing, but I don't mind the loneliness of the room. I kind of love the challenge of the blank page, and it's torturous and it crushes me at times, but, yeah. But I've never really had these. A couple times in school, I had to write something with somebody, but I think it's because I'm so not really a good gen at having a schedule or an outline, and that my writing is sort of, I'm scribbling in a notebook and then one day I'll actually write it down. But the next day I may not have any ideas. And so it's so sporadic that I've never really been able to work in an environment where it's like, hey, if you show up at 8, we're going to sit down and we're going to write, because I could sit there and go, I don't have the muse in me and we're going to be sitting here. And so mine has always been a very lonely, just sitting in my office, hoping it comes to me. And listen, sometimes it does, you know, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes even when it comes to you, it's crap and you got to throw it away and start again. And so I think the movie experience, and when I was writing Mare, I thought it could be a movie, but then it was too much of a community story. There was no way you'd be able to get it all in there. And so it just made sense to go into TV. And it was my initial experience in TV. But I kind of wrote it like a movie. So right. It didn't really change the way I wrote. I wrote it like a movie and you know, here we are. So, I mean, I loved it, but it killed me along the way.
Sure. Did you break it up into episodes as you were writing, or was it kind of longer like a movie? I mean, I guess there's like cliffhangers and stuff, so it's probably.
Yeah. So I think we had to like lean in. It became evident early, like it's got to be cliffhanger ending. And that I kind of understood was, you know, how you had to get an audience engaged and keep them engaged in TV. But that's the thing, is like, that's what I so admired about Hacks. Like every episode had so many setups and payoffs. Like I would ask you, like, how did you come up with the big hands? Because that pays off in the last episode, but it's set up so early, it's still paying off. Is that something that you guys say in the room? Go, hey, this big hands idea, I think we can use this joke 9 times. Or like, is that how it works?
Kind of. I mean, what's interesting about that joke and specifically is like when we were, you know, we started working on this idea in 2015 and we started just pitching ideas for these characters and we were laughing to ourselves about the idea that Deborah would make fun of Ava for having big hands. And that was just kind of a little bit that we always thought was funny and we ended up putting in the show. And so then when Hannah Einbinder was cast as Ava, some people were like, did you know that she had like, what was that? And it's like, no, that was just a total joke. But then what is so funny about that photo in the last, like one of the last scenes of the finale is that that's a real photo that Hannah just had. It's not like people thought it was Photoshop. It's not. She was like, it's so funny. Cause we came to her and we were like, we just want you to know, like this joke was written before you signed on. It's not like a comment on your actual physical appearance. And she was like, you know, what's so funny is I have a photo I need to show you guys. And then the next day she brought in that photo and we were like, it's perfect. My God, it's perfect. But yeah, I think like, on a larger, like the three of us are just always looking for running bits that make us laugh. And once you find one, you're like, oh, this is like, you can keep mining this for stuff. And that's so much about what people love about comedy shows specifically, I think, is that there's a joke and that's funny. And then like it keeps recurring and then it makes the audience feel like they're part of the joke too, you know? So that was just, that I think is something that we just kind of naturally do in our writing, is find these things that tickle us and then hopefully tickle everyone enough that when you return to them a couple of times, it's satisfying. So you wrote this, you wrote Mare on Spec, so there was no pitch process, right?
No, because I'm a horrible pitcher. I'm like, I am the worst in the room, and I never have any, I don't have any high concept ideas. If I were to come into a room and say, hey, I have a story about a detective, a girl's gone missing in town, I'd be laughed out of the room. I feel like it's a story that's really, like, it's so execution-based.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's a story we've seen a million times, but how do you do it?
Slightly differently.
How do you engage the audience in a different way? And so I was pretty convinced if I were to go pitch this, I wouldn't get anywhere. So my idea was, if I can write it and write in a convincing way and write with some authority about this place, you know, where I grew up, so it was a little bit easier in that way. Then I was convinced maybe there would be something. But I wrote it. I kind of liked one episode, but I wasn't convinced I had the story. So I wrote another episode all on spec. And then we were trying to cast it. We had some ideas. But obviously Kate was the top choice. I didn't expect her to read it quickly or even read it at all. You know what this is like. You never know what actors are going to respond, how they're going to respond. It could take a month, but Kate read it. I mean, almost overnight, which was shocking.
Wow.
Because I think she was getting ready to do Ammonite. And I think, you know, I think Mare was a change of pace. It was a totally different world. Mm-hmm. She never held a gun in any role she'd ever played, which was surprising.
I read that you said that. She was excited by the fact that, like, in all of her wonderful parts over the years, she'd never held a gun, which that's fascinating.
I was shocked. And so I think she was looking to do something, you know, different. And then once you have Kate, obviously a story becomes way more appealing. And once Kate came on, we were able to go at that point. But even then, we didn't really pitch it. We kind of said, here are the scripts.
Yeah.
And then I kind of walked them through what I imagined would happen the rest of the way. And, you know, we got really lucky with HBO and we got to make the show and shoot it in the town where it was set, which was a huge luxury. We got really, really lucky with that. And then working with Gene and Kate and Julianne and just wonderful actors, it was a gift, really.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up how pitching it wouldn't have, in your mind, been successful because it's so execution dependent. And I think that's such a interesting point and kind of a damning part of the pitching process, because I think there are so many wonderful stories and scripts that probably don't get bought because the execution is what is going to make them. Like, what is so wonderful about your show is, yes, there is this mystery element and you're following this like thrilling story, but it's the execution of it is, I think, what makes it so special. It is so specific to this world. These characters are so specific. There's humor injected into it, despite it being like a very dark kind of story. Like, and I don't totally know, like you're saying, how you convey that in a pitch. Like, you really need to see it on the page and in some ways see it on the screen or see, you know, and so it's so interesting because I think the thing that makes your project so wonderful, right, it would be difficult to pitch.
It's so true. And I think it's a tricky line because you don't want to invest a lot of time into something. And this is always a gamble, right? You spend time writing something that doesn't get bought. Wow, have I wasted my time? Sometimes an agent or manager or anyone who's advising you will say, well, just go pitch it. That way you're not investing the time. But it's a tricky thing because sometimes the only way to know is to write it. And that's a gamble too.
Right.
But how did you guys do Hacks then? So what was your pitch process? How did that go?
Yeah, it was interesting. We were, you know, it's still like kind of not an easy ask to say, hey, we want to make a show about a 70-year-old woman. Like, that is not, you know, that's not what they lead with in screenwriting school when they teach you how to get a job. And so that was interesting. That was an interesting part of it. And to, you know, luckily a few places got it and wanted to, you know, at least were interested. But I think HBO Max, more than any place, we've talked about this, Susanna Makos, when she heard the pitch, was like, yes, I absolutely get this. I love this. I know this. Mm-hmm.
Was Gene attached at this point? Gene was not attached.
Okay. Gene was not attached. Gene only became attached. We sold it to HBO Max. It was not picked up to series. It was a pilot production commitment. So we were knew we were going to get to write the pilot and then make it. So we write the pilot. And then we send it to Gene, and kind of the same thing with Kate. Like, we, you know, you just never know. You're like, yeah, I don't know. Gene's smart. That would be incredible, but who knows? Mm-hmm. And, just luckily she responded. And then once she was on board and then also the world shut down, it was, they were like, okay, maybe use this time to just write the first season and you can go to series, which was, it was in a very dark time. It was a bright light. It was a wonderful show of fate from HBO Max. And we felt really supported. And then, you know, of course, having, like you said, like once you got Kate, like once we got Gene, like the world just opened up, like it just becomes, you can see it so clearly.
Yep. And so what was it like, obviously working with Gene as the star of the show? How was that experience?
It was lovely. It was, she is, you know, you have this expectation coming in. I certainly was like just a huge fan of hers from Designing Women to Brady Bunch movie, to Watchmen, to like everything. And you're like, oh God, I hope she's great. I hope she's great. Cause I love her. And she just truly surpassed every expectation I had. She was such a pro, so good. And such a also wonderful like leader on set. It was really wonderful to get to work with her. And I think what's so fun, and this is what people loved about her and your show too, is like she is in her bones like a comedian. She is so deeply funny. Like she is just, we shot this scene, which you probably remember, where her and Hannah have a kiss and like a dream sequence. Mm-hmm. And Gene, after that, like walked around, like slinked around set with like a postcoital cigarette hanging out of her mouth as like a bit doing prop comedy. She's just so funny, and she's so funny in your show. Like it's just wonderful. She is such a pro. I don't know if you notice this, but like, maybe this is because of a theater background, but she's such a, you know, there are actors, some actors who are still great actors who don't really read the script as close. Like they're reading their dialogue, but they're not reading everything else necessarily. And she is such an incredible like student of the script. She knows, like she reads the action so precisely, and she's like, oh no, but it says here that I need to, you know, she's just so on top of that. And it's such a like lovely thing as a writer to have your script honored in that way by her. That's what, something I was like really struck by and impressed by.
No, totally. I had the same experience with Gene. It was, you know, I think, you know, with a lot of the actors, you know, we would go into like the deep dives of the backstory and how the characters arrived here. But there was something about Gene where she kind of like instantly knew who the character Helen was. And just like, and I also think there was this kind of, I don't know how Gene knew, but there was an understanding that the show is like really heavy at times. And we need to lean on the comedy as a breath of air. It's so, so important. And I think whenever we had a moment where we felt even like, is this an opportunity to have a laugh? Like we'd always have to lean on Gene and Kate to give it to us, because that relationship was sort of the one we would use. And I think what her character and what Gene was able to do was keep the levity alive. I mean, we had I'll never forget, we have a scene in the last episode where like all this terrible stuff has happened and Kate comes home and she's been at court all day, and Gene, like, she goes over to touch the iPad or the TV, spills off the chair, starts laughing. And it's just like, it was a scene you probably, I think there was a way, or there was some discussion, oh, well, that feels a little bit odd just because of all the stuff going on. But it was so important to have those moments, because in real life, you're like, it happens. You're crying and then you're laughing. And like,
it's so true. I don't think it's a coincidence that these projects have Gina in common, because she is so wonderful at like switching tones, because she's equally gifted in drama and comedy, which is so rare.
Yep.
And that was exactly important for us too in Hacks. Like, it is a comedy. It's a half hour comedy. It's from people who have exclusively worked in comedy. So you expect it to be funny, I think, but we also wanted it to have real grounded emotional moments. And so for us, that's why we cast Gina, is because we said she embodies that ability to switch tones, because she can do it so believably on either side of it. And exactly, she does it in Mayor so well.
And in Hacks too, because that's what's so like moving at the end when she comes to Ava's house, is that it's just such a great arc, and it speaks to her changing who she is in a way, but then still being who she is, because they had that conversation on the bed. Yeah. I forget the dialogue, but she's sort of like, well, this is the way to cry, really. But
She's being funny in a really dark, difficult moment.
Sell the drama too. That's the thing with Gina. Yeah. She can sell the tenderness and the humanity, and yet she can make you laugh. And I think that's her genius in these shows is whenever we needed her to turn on and go, all right, now it's got to be tender because Mayor needs a hug or Mayor needs you to say something. She was able to instantly go into that mode too. And that's really tricky. And Gene is a master of it.
Yeah, she really is. Well, it has been so lovely getting to talk to you. I am such a fan, and I'm so glad I got to ask you a bunch of questions about this thing that I love and just learn about how you made it.
Yeah, it's been a real honor here. I'm such a huge fan of Hacks, Jen, and I loved every part of it, especially Gene and Hannah together. I thought that was just such a wonderful duo, and appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. Hopefully I'll see you at the Emmys. I'll come over and introduce.
Oh yeah, I'll see you at the Emmys.
Are we going to the Emmys? Is it happening?
As of today we are. Who knows what tomorrow brings.
Exactly right.
But hopefully, yes, we can meet in person at the Emmys. That would be lovely.
Thanks for listening to Trade Secrets. You can stream all of Mayor of Easttown and Hacks right now on HBO Max. Trade Secrets is a production of HBO Max and Pineapple Street Studios. Beyondria July produces the show. Brianna Garrett is our associate producer. Our editor is Darby Maloney. Hannes Brown is our engineer. Gabrielle Lewis is our senior managing producer. Our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky. To support the show, please follow, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. And tell a friend. And as Brad and Jen discussed during the episode, remember, sometimes the best way to prove you can make something is simply to make it. Until next time.